So a neighborhood organizer was a person whose job was to go to a neighborhood and work with the local residents to create an organization that was resident-controlled, we would have said, citizen-controlled, and that this organization would become the voice of that community. So it had to be very representative. And the idea of that organizer was to never be a leader, right? And to create an organization that did not depend on the organizer. That what you were trying to do was to place power in the hands of local residents. Two kinds of power. First, the power to solve problems and create new visions on the basis of the residents and their resources. And the second, when necessary, to use that power to influence or coerce local institutions or downtown institutions to do what you wanted them to do, right? And so that's the career that I was in. And for those of you who have no ancient history, I was doing this in the beginning era of a fellow named Saul Alinsky. Has anybody here ever heard of Alinsky? Okay. He's the goddaddy of neighborhood organizing, right? So I was sort of there at the disciple era, right? the second generation, and I, so that's what I was doing. And then maybe 20 years later, Northwestern University, which is one of the five big universities in the Chicago area, decided they wanted to create a Department of Community Studies, and they asked me if I would come and help them start that department up. And I went to the university, and the university is such luxurious places that I decided never to leave. It's certainly a lot easier than neighborhood organizing, right? And a little sidebar, when I went into the university, another crony of mine, another neighborhood organizer, said to me, you know, now that you are where you are, I'd like to start a national training program for neighborhood organizers. And we would do it in Chicago, and it would be an apprenticeship program, and we would place people who wanted to be trained with all the neighborhood organizations that we have organized, right? So they would learn there. And then we would, our new training group would once a week bring them together and they could share information and we could add additional insight if we had it, that kind of thing. So we agreed I'd be the chairman of the board and he would be the executive director. We managed to get enough money for some stipends for these people who would be apprentice organizers. And we put an ad in three major newspapers, one in New York, one in Chicago, and one in Los Angeles. And the ad said, "Would you like to change the world? If so, write us a letter and tell us why. We are going to select a group of people to be trained as neighborhood organizers to change the world." And we got a lot of letters back, right, from all over the country. And from those letters, we couldn't interview these people, we picked 20 and invited them to Chicago. Some were in Chicago, a lot weren't. They came. And we were giving them the generous stipend of $100 a week. Which I don't know, in pounds would be what, 55, something like that, pounds a week, and placing them in neighborhoods. So the first day when we had all these organizers, these people who wanted to be organizers, they all went around the room and introduced themselves. And the last one was a tall, skinny guy with big ears, and a funny name called Barack Obama, right? And so he spent 3 years with us as learning to be a community organizer, right? And his campaign and his administration reflects very much what he learned in those years, and that's what I'm going to share with you, basically. So when I went to the university, they asked, I was brought there to start this, it was really a program in community studies. And all of you who are interested in community development, you know the problem, right? And it's a definitional problem. If I use the word pitcher, I say, let's you and I talk about pitchers. All I have to say is, pitcher, I don't need to bring one around, do I?
Yes.
No, don't. You know what I'm talking about. No. You don't?
It's American, not English.
Okay, what
it's
would
a
you say?
A jug.
Okay. I picked the wrong thing. I was going to pick a glass, but I don't have a glass. Okay, we'll talk about jugs. Okay, right? And we could do that without looking at it, right? And community is not a word that has a common referent. It's a word which, in its clearest meaning, is different for every single person. What community means to you is, I can guarantee, can't you? Not what it means to her. So if we recognize that there is no authoritative, commonly recognized definition of what you mean by community, right, then we thought we would go to the sociology department. We were new to university, and they know all about groups, right? And we thought we'll go and ask the sociology department for a definition of community. So once they tell us what community is, we'll know what to study. Right? And that was a dumb idea. Because if you go to the sociologist, are there any sociologists in the room? Thank heavens, only one. Only one, right? If you ask for sociologists for an agreed upon and useful definition of community, you, I think, will find little help. In fact, you'll find little help in an encyclopedia. So what you realize is that you have to set your own definition of community. And let me suggest that a lot of people who say they're in community development or they're in community planning or community building, right, are sitting at a table talking about something which most of the time they have never really agreed what they mean. And that's why a lot of this stuff doesn't go very far, right? So we realized that we had to be arbitrary and decide what we meant by community if we were going to study it. Now, what we really meant was, I think, neighborhood, not community. And, or let's say, a space-based community. And so we began then to talk to neighborhood people about their ideas about community. And they were as varied as anybody else. It wasn't very helpful. And then one of our people said, I got an idea of a question we could ask if we're going to do research about neighborhoods and what they do successfully. And here's the question. Question is, you knock on the door, the lady with the jug answers the door, right? And you say, can you tell me what people who live in this neighborhood have done together that has made things better? And sometimes the person who answers the door will say, what do you mean by better? And we would say, whatever you mean. Because we were very interested in what betterness is from a citizen perspective. Right? And so we began collecting those stories, first in Chicago neighborhoods. And then we got a grant that allowed us to go to 20 North American cities, 300 neighborhoods, and ask that question. And in 4 years, we asked that question enough times, because some people didn't have an answer, that we had collected 3,000 stories of what local residents had done together to make things better. Which meant, I think, that we had more information about successful local community building or community development than anybody had ever collected. But there was a problem. And it's, I should say, we gathered this information in Canada and the United States, not just in the United States. And once you have 3,000 stories, you have two problems. First, in up-top universities, which Northwestern is one, they tell me, right? Stories aren't worth anything, right? If you take a story into a university, they say, oh, that's an anecdote, which is a put-down. So it isn't worth anything. So we had the first problem once we entered the university, what were we going to do if we told them we had 3,000 stories? And then a person who was very wise, old professor, said, I'll tell you what to do. And so we did it. So when we came back with our 3,000 stories in a bag, right, it said stories, and we tore the label off. And we put a new label on that said case studies. And we walked in the front door with pride. We had taken lead and transmuted it into gold, right? Nobody had ever had 3,000 case stories. But nobody wanted 3,000 stories in the university. So that was the first thing that was a problem. You understand, we had case studies. And the second thing was, could we publish a book with 3,000 case studies? Who would ever read a book of 3,000 case studies? Obviously no one, I think. So we had to decide, how could we say something in general about these stories that would help anybody who wanted to be successful at the local level in making things better, but not general in a way that was so abstract that it couldn't be useful. So we spent a lot of time looking at the stories from that perspective and concluded that the most common thing we could see in the stories was, what were the people using in this story? What was the raw material? What were the building blocks that the story told you about that were in the neighborhood, right? And from that perspective, we went over 3,000 stories, and they were very varied stories. There might be a story about some people in the neighborhood who got together to do something about a dying little commercial strip, or people who had gotten together to do something to get people to vote, or to work with their daughters to develop some constructive activities, or to create a choir for the community. I mean, they're just totally diverse, these stories. And yet, no matter what the story was about, we could see that there were five different resources that they drew from, right? Five ingredients or five building blocks. Now, the stories hardly ever involved using all five. They might have used two. They might have used two of one and two of three, right? It's a mix and match in that sense. But we did see very clearly that we could tell people locally, and we're not so interested in theory development as we were a way of providing information that could be used by neighborhood people. And so we decided this is useful to remind people of what are the resources that people who make things better use in their local neighborhoods. Now, Then we had the problem of what will we call these five things? You could call them resources or building blocks or ingredients. But we have been in the university long enough that we realized that if we called them ingredients or building blocks, that those were not acceptable terms, because everybody would understand what we were talking about, right? And what we had to do, right, was find a word for these five things that nobody would understand, so they'd come to the university and pay to learn what they already knew, right? I don't know how it is over here, but that's how it is over there, right? And so we searched for a word people wouldn't understand for these five building blocks, and we settled on assets. So there are five assets at the neighborhood level. And we then called ourselves the Asset-Based Community Development Institute, which when we're introduced that way, nobody has the foggiest idea what that means. So we're totally successful. People come constantly to find out what they already knew. And that's what I'm going to tell you now. What are the five assets that everybody knows, right? But probably does not think about as the principal resources for making things better. So I want to remind you of what you know. You all come from a community, right? And I want to remind you in an order you might not have thought of. And I want to remind you through a map. Since we're thinking about a neighborhood, we thought the best way of doing this would be a map. So I'd like to remind you of these assets on the basis of drawing an asset map of a neighborhood. And it is this map, I think, that has resulted in the spread of this. Anybody have our green book here? You know, well, it's called Building Communities from the Inside Out. It's got five chapters, one about applied. It's a workbook for neighborhood people. We printed 500 copies, and it just mushroomed. And there are 110,000 of them been sold all over Canada and the United States. It's the leading book on community development, and we couldn't imagine why at the beginning. But the reason is because of the map, I'm telling you. Because people don't have a practical definition of a local community that can be agreed on and yet is almost universally agreed on, but also is useful. So it just happens to be that what I'm showing you is of that character. One other thought about the word assets. We gathered this information initially almost always in inner-city, low-income neighborhoods, right? And one of the things characteristic about many of those neighborhoods is they have become very dependent on grants from foundations and government. And so one of our team said, you know, a lot of neighborhoods have an economy, but it's a grants economy. And he said a grants economy has an educational effect. And a grants economy teaches you that how economy works is you start out with a lot and you end up with nothing, right? Any of you ever gotten a grant that ends on December 31st? And my gosh, we've got 5,000 pounds left here and it's December 25th. How can we get rid of it, right? So a grants economy is from lots to nothing. And he said, what we're looking at is assets. Because an asset is something that's small at the beginning, and if you invest it correctly, it will grow, right? So what we're watching is the investment of community assets that starts with something small and makes something better. So that's really why I think we ended up with the word assets. So I'm going to show you a map. And I want to show it in order. And the first asset, and I want you all hold your breath here, because it's the one asset that appeared in every single story. It's the only universal asset in stories making things better in the local neighborhood. And this is it. You see it back there? You see it? Okay. It's local residents, right? The primary asset. Not leaders, not professionals. Residents, right? They are the flower in the cake, universal. Now, that is not accurate, however. And it's not accurate for this reason. Do you know the glass? The kid's question, is the glass half empty or is it half full, right? Now, incidentally, this is an interesting cultural difference. If you ask this in the United States, the people will argue, no, it's half full, no, it's half empty. And every time I've asked the question in the UK, people say, yes, right? So you're much brighter, right? It is. The answer to the question, is it half full or half empty? The answer is yes, right? And so you're more cooperative in your mentality, I think, you know? Less individualistic, competitive, right? But everybody, every single person in the story was like this glass, right? Every single person had gifts, skills, abilities, and capacities. And every single person also had deficits, problems, deficiencies, and needs. Right? And the most important thing that I think grew out of this research was something that if you think about it for more than a minute, anybody knows, but almost all of our institutions in society are based on not knowing it. And it is that what we were seeing was the identification and mobilization of the gifts and the capacities of local residents and ignoring their deficits, problems, and needs. Right? That's what you're reading. And so the real picture should look like this. Right? The first asset is not people or residents. It is the gifts and capacities of local residents. Now, the reason that begins to seem significant if you do this kind of research is in the very same neighborhoods where you can see what you're looking at is the manifestation of gifts and capacities, there are also a series of institutions that say they want to help the neighborhood. And those institutions usually, not all, usually, go to a university and say, we want to help this Englewood low-income neighborhood. And so we need you to do a study for us. We'd like you to find out what's missing in the neighborhood, right? We want you to study the empty half, right? So what we want you to do is to find out how many teenage pregnant girls there are, how many bad houses there are, how many drug addicts there are. And we're coming to you as a university because we want to get it very accurate. Because what we want is to quantify misery exactly. Right? Now, there's a name for the quantification of misery in neighborhoods, right? And fortunately, I have to explain it because it never happens here in England and in Scotland and in Ireland. No, I mean, maybe not the UK. Okay. I know you're not English, right? It never happens here in the UK. But in the United States and Canada, we are hell-bent on misery counting. But we call it by a nice name. We don't call it by its real name, the quantification of misery. We call it needs surveys. Now, I know you don't ever have those over here, right? because they are obviously the wrong way to start, right? So you're much more intelligent people than we are. But a needs survey says the way you begin is looking at deficits. Universities identify them. Governments want to know about them. Foundations want to know about them. So you have a whole institutional array that focuses neighborhoods on their deficits. Whereas if you look at what people are doing, it's the exact opposite. And so there's always a tension at the local level between needs-based people and asset-based neighborhoods, right? Because if I, what's your name?
Tanya.
If I said, if Tanya felt about himself that he's got a degree in anthropology, he can play the piano beautifully, right? He's a pretty good soccer player, right? And I came to him all the time and said, Tanya, I notice you have bad eyes. You're wearing those glasses. And I like to test you because I want to find out if you have heart disease. Right? And I want to give you another test to see how short of a level of knowledge you are so I can fix you up, give you more knowledge, right? So do you see how it comes out in the lives of people? There are two ways of approaching them, right? And community building decides that the important way is based on gifts, capacities, and skills, and that information, rather than deficits, problems, and needs. And I'm from a university, an urban research center. We want to help people in cities. And let me tell you how we work. And if you're in a university, you know this is true yourself. But I'd like you to think about the group you work with. So I work with a department in the university, faculty members. Think about the group you work with. And now let me describe my group, and you apply the same. Right? The particular faculty I'm in has been voted across American universities in the annual tournament as the best department of its kind in the United States. We get that about every other year. So we are a well-recognized positive group of 17 people. And three weeks ago was the last faculty member I attended meeting. And let me tell you about the faculty. But I want you to think about your group this way. First person I can tell you about is me. I have heart disease. I have a big bypass operation. It's had a big effect on my life. Next to me at the faculty meeting is a guy named Paul. And Paul was diagnosed with cancer about 3/4 of a year ago. They operated on him last summer. It apparently has not worked. Paul's dying right there. Right. Next to him is a woman named Anne who got a divorce a couple years ago. Her children went with her. Last summer, for some reason, they decided to leave her and go and live with her ex-husband. And her family has fallen apart before her eyes. Next to her is a guy named Charles, who is absolutely mad. If a psychiatrist ever found Charles, we'd never see him again. I mean, he's just crazy as a coot. Yeah. But he is the best scholar of English rhetorical history in the United States. Now, that's the first four members of our faculty. Would you like to hear about the other 13? And every group you're in is like that, if you're honest and serious. You would know that's true. Why are we the best faculty? How is it that such a messed up group of people could be the best faculty? Right? How is it people who are so, so deficient could be so recognized? And you all know the answer from your own group. But we don't think about it, I think. You decide to ignore each other's deficits, problems, deficiencies, and focus on your gifts, your capacities, and skills. That's how every effective group does. And a good university is sort of a nest, right, that nurtures the full half and helps us ignore our deficits and needs. Right? Now, what do all of us from institutions that want to help tend to do? We know that what makes us work is working together around our gifts and capacities. And we walk right out of the university and we go into a neighborhood and we say to them, we are important because we have gifts and capacities and we ignore our deficiencies. But you people, it's the reverse. We are not going to do unto you what we do to ourselves. We're going to do the reverse. And we're going to approach you and saying, well, you poor sucker with those bad eyes, bad heart, lack of information. Right? So there's an inversion between professionals and their own behavior and how they deal with citizens. And that's the great anomaly, but it's the great challenge. How could professionals be supporters and enhancers of the full half, which is going to make things change, rather than purveyors of the culture of need and deficit and aggrievement? And we spend a lot of time with people from all kinds of professions and institutions working through what would you do if you really believed in citizens, really believed in their capacity, and therefore thought your primary responsibility was not to fix them, but to support them. What would you look like? If I could do anything as a result of these minutes with you, it would be to urge you at the next meeting of your group to examine that question. So there's the first asset, the gifts and the capacities and skills of local people. A little warm here. What's the second one? The second thing that appears in lots of the stories is small groups of local people. And these groups, the members do the work. They're usually face-to-face scale. And they're not paid. Right? And so we went to our graphics department and told them about that and asked them how we could do that. What's a graphic for those small groups? And they came up with this. You have to be in a university to do this. So. Right. Which is a small group of people in the local area who come together to do all kinds of things. Diverse. But they're not paid, right? And they may have a paid member, like a pastor or a religious leader of some kind, or an organizer or a secretary. But the essential reality is the members do the work, essential work, and they're not paid, right? So we wanted to get an official name for these groups. We could call them small groups or little organizations. There was no commonly recognized name, but there is historically a recognized name, and it is associations. These groups are, in a political science department, called associations. And it's obviously a collective word, and it has a clear history because its use as a word was developed by one man, a Do you know a French count named Alexis de Tocqueville? Right. Well, he's the namer, and he called them associations. Right. And it was but an association. If I said flock, what is a flock? You'd say birds, right? If I said association, what would you say? Since he named it, we know what it is. Citizens, not people, not individuals, not residents, citizens. And what is a citizen? A citizen is a person who has the universal power with every other person in that domain to define the future and produce it. That's what a citizen is. Freedom is useless without those two powers. The power to define what is to be done and the power to do it. And that's, so a citizen is the name for someone who acts powerfully. An association is a powerful tool. And the reason that they are powerful is, I think, this. We would ask people at the end of each story, where did this story start? And the in over of the first 3,000, about 1,700 started with an association. So then what we could realize is if you wanted to know what is the fountainhead, the spring from which community change is generated, most frequently it's the associations. And then the question came to us, if we saw this over and over again, why? What is it that leads associations to be this vehicle? And I think we came to believe, and I think it's probably even true, this is the reason. That an association is merely a vehicle to aggregate the gifts, skills, and the capacities of local residents. It's the collective form of this individual. But in coming together around gifts, capacities, and skills, each individual has more power than they did alone, and as a collective, they are more than the sum of the parts. And that's why they're so important. Right? Now, we know this is true in North America, but I didn't know whether this is true in the United Kingdom. And about 2 years ago, I think it was 2 years ago, I was at the University of Dundee, where I think was held the sort of National Association of Community Development Organizations, local ones. And while I was there, before I went, because I was supposed to open a conference, I said to them, I don't know whether what we found is true here. Do you have associations in Scotland? Do people belong to these kinds of groups? And when I got there, they said, look, come over here to the computer. And they went to the site of the Dundee city government. And lo and behold, the Dundee city government had sponsored a method for inventorying the associations in Dundee, right? And in fact, from their webpage, here is a typology of associations that people belong to in Dundee. And there are a couple thousand of them. So I can't show you all, but just to give you an idea what's there, you can look it up yourself. They keep updating it. There are the associations starting with A and going to AG. So just for the letter A, there are four more pages of associations, but that many on a page. So when you get through the alphabet, there's a couple thousand. Right? Here's M to ME. Here's S to SC. And if you're interested, there's the website. Right? Now, I don't know if that's common, maybe that you would find an associational inventory done by cities or not. It's not common in the United States. I was really enheartened to see that they thought associations were important enough that they would inventory them. Okay. So, at any rate, let's put the associations on the map. There they are. Right. Now, the third asset that appeared in the stories was groups of local people, just like the associations, excepting they're paid. Paid groups of local people appear in the story. Less frequently than associations, but they appear. And we all have, I think, the common idea that there are three kinds of paid groups, right? The first is for-profit, the second is not-for-profit, and the third is the state or government. So they appear in the stories. Appears businesses, appears in the story, maybe a hardware store or a lawyer in the lawyer's office or a child care agency or a YMCA or a school, a library or park. Right? They always are appearing in the stories as assets. And so we wanted to put them on the map, and we went to the High Text Graphic Center and posed this difficult question. Is there one symbol we could use for all three of these kinds of paid groups of people? Do they have anything in common? Does a local factory, a child care agency, and a library have anything in common? So we could just use one symbol. And they said it'll take 2 weeks for us to figure that one out. But they came back with something so brilliant that they said, here it is. They all have one thing in common. And that's it. They're structured in this way. And they said, so they are triangles, or associations are circles. Right? And we would add that I think our research indicates that triangles are one kind of tool because of their structure, and circles are another kind of tool because of their structure. One is a hammer, one is a saw. If you try to use one to do what the other one can do, you're going to fail. Right? So let's put these on the map. And there they are, the triangles, the businesses and the agencies and not-for-profits and the governmental local institutions. So those are the three human assets, three forms that human assets take in the stories. The fourth asset is the physical environment, is the space on which they act out the story of the community, right? And that's the land. All improvements on it, and that may be of value under it, will appear in various stories. A vacant lot may appear, which the local neighborhood group is going to make into a children's playground, for instance. Then the fifth asset, there's no way to think of it on a map in a way, but it is that in lots of the stories, there's an exchange. People are sharing things, giving things, bartering things, trading things, buying things, and selling things. The world of exchange, right? And so we've got that indicated by the arrows, right? The exchange. So those are the five assets that no matter what the story was about, it is about one of those, or two of those, or three of those. Hardly ever all five. So the first thing I can report to you is successful ventures is depends on people who understand that they have those things and they are valuable. Right. Now there are two other primary findings that's true of all the stories. And let me tell you one story and then I can show you from that story all three of the essential principles. This is a story, it's a knock on a door in a lower income, on the edge of working class neighborhood. I remember this is in Chicago. And a lady came to the door, and I asked her the question, can you tell me whether people who live around here have done anything together that makes things better? And she thought for a bit, and then she said, well, I suppose. She said, 2 summers ago, my daughter, she became a teenager, and when the summer vacation came, she was free. She didn't have anything particular to do, so she ran around with the teenage girl next door. And she said, by the end of the summer, I felt they were going down the wrong path. That's the way she put it, wrong path. And if I didn't do something about that, by the next summer, they would be in trouble. I had to figure out something for next summer. So she said, I'm a good friend of the mother of the girl she was running around with, who lives next door. So I went next door, and I said, I said, this is a problem. And I think I want to try to do something. What about you? And she said, oh, yeah, I can see that too. So she said, we sat down, and we began to dream up things that they could do the next summer. And she said, it became fun. So we got together 2 or 3 times, thinking up more and more things they could do. And she said, we thought up so many things for them to do that we realized we couldn't supervise them doing it, just the two of us. So we knew at least 6 other mothers on the block that had teenage daughters. So we invited them over to have a potluck at my house. And we told them what we had done, what we had thought up, and asked them if they'd like to join in. And she said, all of them had the same experience as we did, and they said, sure. And so we had a couple more potlucks, and we thought up a lot more things to do. And she said, then, by the beginning of the summer, we had all kinds of things to do. She said, then we divided it up into 8 days. So every 8th day, each one of us took charge as the adult involved, but that allowed us to have time to do the other things we were doing. And she said we had so many girls now involved that we had to have a meeting place. So we went across the street there to Latham Park, and we talked to the park manager who about the park building, and he said that we could use a room on the second floor as our gathering meeting place. And so that's what she did, and she said it was a huge success. And I said, well, what did you do? And she said, she began to give me examples. Let me summarize them. They did 3 kinds of things. The first thing is they went on field trips to institutions to learn about the institution. So she said, for example, we went to an insurance company and spent time, and the girls learned about insurance. None of them knew hardly anything about insurance. They weren't going to learn it in school, but now they had learned about insurance. And they also learned what people do and began to see the kind of jobs that people have. So their whole vision began to grow in terms of, as we went to each place, what kinds of work you might think of, what kinds of future you might think of. And as you know, that is very important because most of these girls' vision of the future comes to them through that great artificial information system called television. So they think that a future is being Britney Spears, right? When in fact, they have absolutely no real idea about vocation and its future. So she said that was wonderful. They got both those things. And then she said, we have a lot of artistic people among the 8 of us and in the neighborhood, so we would have a different artist come in and spend a day with the girls, show them how they did their artistic thing, and get them involved. So they tested out their artistic abilities and talents and have begun to follow the ones that they find best. And then we asked them to do a project that made the block better every week, to come up with a different project, work together and do that. And they had all kinds of things they did. And one of the things she told me about was they went to each family. Each family was asked to create a coat of arms. What are the symbols for your family that tell about your family? And then the girls took those symbols and made a flag for each family. And when you go to that block, you see a family flag hanging out in front of each house. And the families then told each other about them. And in a funny way, this broke all kinds of doors open in terms of who we are inside. So that's the kind of thing they did during the summer. And then she concluded and she said, but, she said, I think the best thing was we broke all the lines. And I said, what do you mean? And she said, we broke the lines between the mothers. We broke the lines between the mothers and the girls. We broke the lines between the girls. And she said, I'll never forget it, with her full heart, we're a real community now. Right? Now, that's the kind of story we collect. How does it go on the map? This is a story about a woman who had the gift of believing she could think up and produce a different future for her daughter. That's what a citizen does. And she created an association of mothers and girls, and they made a relationship with a local park where they could meet. So that tells us the three things that's in every story. Number one, it is about assets. Number two, it is about assets that are unconnected becoming connected. And I can't overemphasize that from a community building perspective, the critical action is not leadership or technical, it is connective. And we're doing a lot of research on how does that happen? What is connection about? And the third thing is, knowing the first two things won't make anything happen. That all these initiatives had an organization, an association, or an institution that acted as the initiator of connections, right? Not the initiator of deficit definition and professional intervention, which is a totally different non-community development activity, right? So those three things, I can report, are common to all. And so the other thing, when we're asked to go to a neighborhood or someplace, now and sort of see what we think is happening, whether we have any advice, we spend all our time trying to find out who are the individuals who are connectors, who are the associations who are connectors, who are the institutions who are connectors, right? Because we know that's the best predictor of community building and development, right? I want to then open things for questions, but I want to say one or two other things before we take that off. Let me tell you about another possibility. Let's imagine this woman's name is Mrs. Green, and that Mrs. Green sees the trouble with her kid at the end of the summer. And what she does is she goes over to the park manager and says, my girl is getting in trouble. And the park manager calls up the next level of his system, up the boxes, and he says to them, do we have any kind of programs or program officials who can do things, especially for girls who are teenagers? And they call across to here and they say, yes, we've got a special funding for this, for this girls' development effort. And so we'll send two of our certified girl developers, right, into the neighborhood for next summer. And the girl developers could have come, and the girl developers would have done their thing, which they had learned in a university, probably, right? And I suspect that that was not bad. The girl developers think they are community developers, and they are not. They have headed off community development. You hear me? I'll say it again. The girl developers are heading off community building development. Because until these people are central to the action, you won't build a citizen-centered community. What you will do is create an ever more dependent population of local clients. And a lot of neighborhoods are places filled with people who, if properly labeled, would be called clients. Now, client comes from the Greek. It was developed in the era of Hippocrates in 400 BC in general, as medicine first developed, and Hippocrates developed the word client because it came from a root, Greek root, kli, C-L-I. This is a root that we know in client, but we know it in recline, same C-L-I. And it means a person on their back, right? A person so bad off that they're on their back, a client, right? Clients are not citizens. The Greeks knew that. They had another word derived from city and citizen, which meant a person who is standing powerfully with the ability to have a vision and make it come so. So the girl developers would, in fact, increase the belief here that triangles raise children and that citizens don't have a role. And I'm sure that's the unintended side effect. But if I had to bring any other question to the fore, it would be that one. How would institutions act if they said, the most powerful community building thing we know is these stories. What could we do to support them? Maybe it's only saying to all the park managers, why don't you try to find out, look on the website and find out what associations people belong there and go and invite them to meet in your park. Right? Maybe it would only be that. Or a thousand other things that people might invent. The last thing about the map that I want to point out is you see the difference between the green space and the red space and the blue space. The green space is, in the world of political science, civil society. It is the place where social capital is generated. It is the place that depends on trust rather than money. Triangles are held together by money. Civil society is held together by trust. And they are radically different in their capacities. But the green space that I'm telling you about, the associative and individual expression, I don't know here, but in the United States, the Constitution, the first article of the Constitution says the reason we're revolting is to have two freedoms, freedom of association and expression. And they are the core of a democracy. So the last thing I want to point out to you is that institutions don't create that reality. They can allow it. Right? And we know from the 20th century, don't we, that there were two great tyrannies that had great institutions and no green space. And the way they kept in power was to never allow people, individual expression to take place or them to do it together in association. They stomped out or took over every bit of green space. So our dedication to institutions, their growth, their proficiency, and their efficiency does not mean our democracy is growing at all. The real measure is the green space. What's happening there? It's not how many times a year can I be a client of a professional that is a predictor of a democracy. So the heart of democracy is civil society. And I think most social historians would agree that there have been great progress in the 20th century, but we have one negative side effect, and that is the triangles have grown huge and often overshadowed the circles. And that the 21st century challenge is, can we get it back into balance? Can citizens become not clients, but the center of our society, be citizens with the capacity to raise their children, for instance? Right? And so that's the other thing I think this research poses, is how do we enter the 21st century moving in the reverse direction that we have moved? And if you go to our website, which I'll have to put up there someplace, we have a bunch of workbooks, and one was written by the city manager of Savannah, Georgia, who of all the people at the top of a pyramid we ever met, right, at the top of a triangle, did more to foster citizen life, citizen engagement, the growth of this kind of thing than anybody else. And we said to him, Mr. Moore, will you write a guidebook for public officials for us that will tell them how you did that? And he did. You can get it there on our website. But I wanted to end with the title. He titled his book as the man at the top, Leading by Stepping Back. And I think that's the challenge ahead.